Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, October 2, 2015, during a live Courthouse Steps teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federalist Society's Practice Group teleform conference call. Today, we'll be discussing Clay versus U.S. It's about regulatory crimes in an important case being argued earlier today in the 11th Circuit. For additional materials on today's call, we have a Federalist Society blog post that can be found at fedsoc.org/blog at the Federalist Society's fairly newly launched blog. We also have recorded a previous teleform conference call on this same topic, although not including an assessment of the oral argument. That was recorded in July, and it's available on the Federalist Society's website also under Practice Group Podcasts. I, by the way, am Dean Reuter. I'm Vice President and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that during our call today, all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on the call. Also, we're recording this call for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome back two guests to our call today. We're going to hear opening remarks from each of them, sort of a little bit of opening remarks and some back and forth, more of a conversation than we might typically have at the outset for about the first 30 minutes. But then, as always, we'll be turning to you for your questions, so please have those in mind when we get to that part of the program. We'll hear first from Paul D. Kaminar. He's a senior fellow at the Administrative Conference of the United States. He'll be followed by John J. Park, Jr., Jack Park, of counsel at Strickland Brockington Lewis, LLP in Atlanta. With that, Paul, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Dean. I want to, again, thank the Federalist Society for hosting this teleforum and the one you did the other month or two ago. And this is a very important case, I think, for these Federalist Society members to be aware of on over-criminalization and how this works with respect to our regulatory state and what companies and individuals have to comply with in that regard. Let me just give a quick background of this particular case. In 2007, the offices of a medical services provider company in Tampa, Florida, were raided by over 200 FBI and law enforcement officers. The company was WellCare Health Plans, and they quickly agreed to a deferred prosecution agreement with the Justice Department and threw their four top executives under the bus, so to speak, including its CEO, CFO, and general counsel, and a couple vice presidents. The executives were indicted for health care fraud for allegedly not complying with Florida's so-called 80-20 statute. Now, under that law, contracts with Florida's Agency for Healthcare Administration, otherwise known as ACA, must require that if a plan spends less than 80% of the Medicaid premiums given to it, quote, for the provision of behavioral health care services, end quote, the balance has to be returned to the Florida Medicaid Department. So the central question here is, how does one define, quote, for the provision of, end quote, behavioral health care services in computing this 80-20 ratio? Now, WellCare's method of including payments it made to its affiliated company, was approved by WellCare's general counsel and a former director of Florida's Medicaid department as a reasonable interpretation of the statute. Tellingly, the other competitors similarly counted payments made to an affiliated company as part of the expenditures that the provider can count in this 80-20 formula. Now, at trial, even numerous prosecution witnesses, including three lawyers, testified that WellCare's methodology was a reasonable interpretation of the statute and the contracts. And more importantly, I think we should be, for this case, is that the agency did not promulgate any regulations whatsoever on what they mean by this seven words in the statute for the provision of health care services. There are no Florida rules. Nothing prohibited this methodology. Now, the key issue here is a case called United States versus Whiteside in the 11th Circuit that held that the government must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant's statements or submission is, quote, not true under a reasonable interpretation of the law. And here, as in this case, the question involves a legal construction of a statute, and the underlying contracts determines whether, you know, it's a reasonable interpretation. And that is a question of law that should be decided by the judge, and in this case, it was decided by the jury. Now, the jury came back after a three-month trial. They were originally hung, came back, and they acquitted the defendants of most of the charges. The CEO, and I'll tell you who's representing the parties in the court today, the CEO, Todd Farah, was represented by Seth Waxman. He was charged with 9 counts. He was acquitted on 6. There's one count there was a hung on, and then he was convicted of 2 health care fraud counts for calendar year 2006. There were several years that were charged in the in this case. He was acquitted of all those except for 2006. The CFO, Paul Behrens, was represented by Jeff Lampkin, formerly in the Justice Department as well, and he was convicted of a false statement and health care fraud for just 2006, not any of the other years. There was a vice president, Clay, who was represented by Larry Robbins, another Supreme Court advocate, of 2 false statements to the FBI, and finally another vice president, Kale, represented by Stanley Reed, had 1 fraud count. So that was the lineup in the court today, and so the court now was going to hear the appeal. And Jack, can you sort of take us into the courtroom and tell us who the panel was?
Yes, I join Paul in thanking the Federalist Society for its hosting this call. Paul and I attended the oral argument. As Paul said, it was a completely full courtroom, and the panel here in Jacksonville was Judge Joe Flatt, who was a Nixon appointee from 1975, former Chief Judge of the Circuit, in from Atlanta, Judge Hull from the 11th Circuit, and she's a 1997 Clinton appointee, and in from the Southern District of Georgia, sitting by designation, Judge Hall, and he's a 2008 Bush appointee. What I'd like to do is talk about the Whiteside issue and then where the court spent its time, which was kind of trying to find out from counsel the facts which would go toward the Whiteside issue. And then Larry will talk about a mens rea issue, or Paul will talk about a mens rea issue, and then I'll talk about another evidentiary issue. But in Whiteside, the question is really who decides, and it was not very much the discussion. That who decides was not much of the discussion in the oral argument. In Whiteside, an 11th Circuit panel said that where there's an ambiguous statute or regulation, and it gets a reasonable reading by a defendant, that reasonable reading negates a crime. Whiteside is a prior panel decision that's entitled to deference until overturned by the en banc court. The question was briefed but not argued. Again, who decides, the court or the jury? As Paul said, if it's a legal question, the court should decide it. And the defendants in this case insisted that the court should decide it. This came out expressly in Seth Waxman's rebuttal, but its argument about under the 80-20 rule is premised on Whiteside. The government responded that the jury got a Whiteside instruction and convicted. So the government's view of this issue is an evidentiary one. If there's evidence to support the verdict, then the verdict stands, and that's very much in the government's favor. For the 80-20 rule, which got most of the questions, in Whiteside terms, what is it in the statute, the contract, or the templates that account for how the money, these Medicaid premiums were used, put WellCare on notice that payments to a wholly owned subsidiary are different from those to an independent provider? And at a couple points, Judge Hall from the 11th Circuit suggested that if the if these payments had been made pursuant to a contract with an independent provider, there would be no case. So something in the statute, the contract, or the templates had to put WellCare on notice that payments to a wholly owned subsidiary are different and treated differently. And Judge Hull had the bulk of the questions, and nearly all of those related to the operation of the contracts. What she was concerned about, what actually went to the bottom line of the providing of behavior health care services, and what in the record shows that. As she asked, if 80% under the 80-20 rule went to the behavioral health care sub, is WellCare done? And WellCare's answer to that is yes. You don't look behind that subsidiary. In the government's view, you would have to look through the subsidiary to the physicians and behavioral and mental health care professionals who were providing the services to find out how much was done. And the question, again, would be how much reached the bottom line and how far do you go? And what put WellCare on notice that 80% had to reach the bottom line even through the subsidiary? There was a question of how many subsidiaries could you use, and the contract says only one, that you can run it through only one. The question is, could the subsidiary provide a minimal level of services? And the answer is, that might not run afoul of the 80-20 rule as WellCare saw it, but it would be difficult to comply with the contract providing only a minimal level of services, and nobody suggests that WellCare did not provide adequate services. There's the question of, does the wholly owned sub allow for the circumvention of the 80-20 rule? And again, if the answer is that WellCare is not on notice that it can't do that, then maybe it's allowed to circumvent the rule. So that's going to be a big contractual issue. If under Whiteside, if it's a matter for the court, then and Whiteside and WellCare's interpretation of the contract was reasonable, then they're entitled to an acquittal. In that regard, Seth Waxman pointed out that Florida didn't really address the issue until 2008, after the fact. And when it did, one of its folks looked at this the provisions and found five reasonable ways of addressing the 80-20 rule, one of which was running it through a wholly owned subsidiary. When Florida went after one of WellCare's competitors civilly, it decided to fold and get an agreement going forward with that competitor. So the civil side of it for Florida has been successful. With respect to So I've talked a little bit about the 80-20 rule. In essence, something in the statute, the contract, or the templates has to support, has to put WellCare on notice that it couldn't do it in Whiteside terms. Paul, do you want to talk about the intent issue?
Yes, I would. Thanks, Jack. I also, just going back to Judge Hall, she was really getting into very much into the weeds on interpreting this contract, and the issue is, where is this defined? What kind of services must be accounted for? The government looked at one provision where they claim it was only that which is actually provided by the medical doctors themselves, and Seth showed there were other parts of this lengthy contract showed otherwise. And as a part of the template that goes with it, where you fill out the form and how much you're spending, I was struck by Judge Hall's assessment of that. She said in one point in the argument, she said, quote, "I'm confused by the template." So here you have the judge saying, you know, look, this is confusing way to figure out this 80-20 type issue. And so the question is, if you have a reasonable interpretation, as Jack just said was the case, there's not even an actus reus. There is no crime, and that was what Seth Waxman. Now, the next issue that I'm going to talk about now is assuming, for the sake of argument, there was a crime committed. As we all know, under criminal law, you have to have the proper scienter or mens rea. And Seth Waxman, both at argument and in his briefs, made it very clear that there was just no evidence that the CEO here was involved in the calendar year 2006 submissions of the numbers. He had no role in preparing these forms that were submitted, et cetera. As I said earlier, he was acquitted of most of the other counts here, and even the judge, Hall herself, noted that, gee, he was acquitted of the 2005, and it looks like he had stronger evidence there of perhaps some misdeeds going on, and yet there's a conviction of 2006 where you have weaker evidence. Now, the question, of course, is what is the level of intent do you need in this case and in other types of criminal white-collar cases? The statute says you have to have a, quote, knowing and willfully execute the fraud. So it's a high standard of intent of mens rea. Now, the jury instruction said to the jury that you can alternatively find the defendant guilty if it was guilty of, quote, deliberate indifference, end quote. Well, Seth Waxman jumped all over that and was citing a recent Supreme Court case called Global Tech, which is a patent case, and it was a civil case, where even there, in terms of whether there's a mens rea, the court said you have to have either actual knowledge that what you're doing is wrong or, quote, willful blindness, end quote. And willful blindness is a lot higher standard of mens rea than the deliberate indifference instruction which the jury got, which is basically, are you negligent in terms of your intent? So I think that they made some very strong points here there was no evidence that the CEO was involved in the submitting of these numbers, assuming that there was a that these numbers were false, and two, that the instruction to the jury was incorrect in terms of what you have to show. And the government didn't really address that, that they try to basically cast it aside, that Global Tech that doesn't apply here because there was no mens rea standard involved. But on rebuttal, Seth Waxman basically drove that point home and saying, look, they're just not the right level of intent being shown here. So that was basically the mens rea issue, but I think a lot of it also, and we'll go to the next topic here, dealt with the government's use of evidence in court where after the company basically cried uncle and did a deferred prosecution agreement with the government and threw the executives under the bus, so to speak, they went to the SEC and restated their financial profits and loss and to basically as part of their wanting to show that they shouldn't be prosecuted. And in doing so, they said, not in effect, but they actually said that their profits were underreported, et cetera. And then that statement was used at trial. And it's at that point that, Jack, if you want to speak to how the counsel, I think Jeff Lampkin, basically showed how that was not properly used at trial.
WellCare is a publicly traded company, so it filed a restatement, as Paul said. It's that restatement is not otherwise admissible, and it came in through the government's expert. Federal Rule of Evidence 703 talks about how if an expert uses facts or data that are otherwise inadmissible, they can be disclosed to a jury only if their probative value substantially outweighs their prejudicial effect. And there was an objection at trial, and the district court didn't make what Jeff Lampkin thought was a finding, and this produced the typical district court question from the district court judge sitting by designation: do I have to make a finding? And the advisory committee notes suggest that the evidence can come in, can be disclosed only if the trial court, quote, finds, close quote. Does that mean a finding? And, of course, the district court thinks that I don't really want, particularly in the course of a trial that went months, how many findings am I going to have to make, and am I going to have to make them in writing? Then there's the other typical appellate question, well, what did the jury see? And Jeff Lampkin pointed to three slides that the jury saw where they went, where, as he put it, the headings tell you what you need to know, that the earnings were materially wrong and needed to be restated. They told that it suggested that there were accounting errors on the 80-20 calculation and there was big dollars involved. So the question is, how, as it came up before the court, who do you cross-examine? How does this come in? And the court asked the government, who do you cross-examine? And that was Lampkin's point. How is this properly admitted even into evidence through expert? And the overlay is as a public record.
Business record.
Yeah, a business record under Federal Rule of Evidence 8036, but that would have to be made in the regular course of the business and be attested to by the custodian. So there are some substantial questions about that. What the mens rea instructional issue and the restatement issue would, if they either of them or both of them go in favor of the defendants, would do is entitle them to a retrial. And as I said, the Whiteside issue would mean there's no crime and that they would be, in effect, acquitted. The court, most of the questions came from Judge Hall. There was only the district court questions from the district court judge and Judge Choflat, who I have seen be very active, was pretty quiet today.
Yeah, Jack, I just wanted to comment one thing about that restatement that I noted with Judge Hall. In my notes here, she said that she has a quote, the problem with the restatement number is the evidence was acquired long after the course of conduct that's at issue here. And she said that this was, quote, big time prejudicial, end quote. So as Jack just said, hey, the balancing test here, does the probative value outweigh the prejudicial value? And on that point, I think the defendants had the better side of the argument. But Judge Hall was very well-versed in the case. There was, at least several dozens exhibit numbers and cited back and forth by the government attorney and counsel for the defendants. So it was a very hot bench, at least with respect to Judge Hall. The argument time was 45 minutes for each side. The 45 minutes on the defendants were divided up four ways, with Seth Waxman getting the lion's share, and the court let him go over at least another 15 or 20 minutes and a few minutes for each side. So that, just the defense, I think, argued a good hour and 15 minutes for their side.
Paul, the government took their full time, so I think it turned out to be about 2 hours worth of argument.
Exactly.
Which is indicative of the nature of the case.
So, go ahead.
I was just going to say, if you gentlemen have concluded your opening remarks, we can turn to the audience.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea, Dave. Why don't we do that?
Okay. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So again, our lines are wide open at this point, no questions pending. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let me just remind the audience while we're waiting that next week the Supreme Court opens its term, 2015. We are putting together a number of courthouse steps teleform conference calls that will address some of the oral arguments happening next week and beyond. So check the Federal Society's website for a schedule of upcoming calls. Also, this year's National Lawyers Convention, the dates are set. Registration is open November 12th through the 14th here in Washington, D.C., of course. Check the website for registration materials as well. Today, of course, we're talking about Clay versus the U.S., and we're visiting with Paul Kaminar and Jack Park. We've got one question pending, then our lines will be open. Push the star button, then the pound button to join the conversation. Let's take our first call.
Hey, good afternoon, gentlemen. This is Mike Doherty, and I'm on a plane, so I'm going to mute this as soon as I finish my question. Can you quickly summarize what's at stake here if the government wins? What's going to be the fallout?
Yes, that's an excellent question, Mike. If the government wins, it basically will jeopardize and criminalize what otherwise would be simple administrative and civil type conduct. This is basically a contract dispute. Plain and simple. And what happens when you have a contract dispute? You sue the other party for a breach of contract. And in this field with healthcare and in other areas there's administrative and civil remedies, the government will be likely to feel emboldened and basically go after both the company, threatening them with criminal prosecution. And then under this new Yates Memorandum policy, we may talk about that later, force them to turn on their executives and try to make something criminal out of this civil case. So the implication is that it really will basically criminalize simple regulatory type conduct, and it just doesn't forebode well at all. Jack, do you have any views on that?
Yeah, I agree, particularly if the Whiteside rule can be assigned to a jury, then it's going to be difficult to police the government on the ambiguity of its regulations or statutes. And in those situations, those on the other side of the table from the government can ask for guidance, and they're not likely to get it. Conversely, in this case, if, as the case suggests, Florida was contracting with a number of companies who were doing the same thing and the feds didn't like it, they could issue guidance to Florida and tell them, hey, don't do this. Don't let people circumvent our 80-20 rule in this way. So as Paul says, there are administrative and civil ways of doing this, and one of the things that we ought to encourage the government to do is pursue those.
And there's another angle to this, too. Lurking behind this case was an issue that also was brought up, but not really argued, but it's in the briefs, that the government used what's called wealth evidence against these defendants to say that here are these defendants, these executives, they have stock options, they're getting paid handsomely, and therefore, ladies and gentlemen, the jury, these are greedy, rich people, and they did something wrong. Look, we had 200 FBI agents raid the company, so you got to come back with something. And even with that, the jury basically acquitted on most of the charges. So that issue is one that also the government may be emboldened to try to sneak in to basically taint the jury by getting this wealth evidence before them. There is a case, by the way, that's pending in the Eighth Circuit that is kind of a similar or analog to that issue, where the healthcare provider looked at a regulation that was promulgated, and it was ambiguous. They interpreted a way that gave them more profit. The government came in, it was a False Claims Act, and said, oh, wait a minute, if you, the regulated community, don't understand or quite get what our regulation, you have a duty to contact us to clarify. And the district judge shut that down right away, saying, look, It's your job, government, to make the regulations clear to those who have to comply with them. They don't have to come back to you. And what's more important, the judge even said, if they want to take an opportunistic view of that regulation, that's the word the judge used, an opportunistic that maximizes their profit, that's perfectly fine and that's not criminal. I mean, these companies are in business for their shareholders to maximize their profits. And so it's basically incumbent upon the bureaucrats and the regulators to, if they want to prohibit certain conduct, to make it clear. Otherwise, if this case is affirmed, it really will open up, the floodgates for the government to prosecute when there's no clear guidance to the regulated community.
We've got plenty of time left. We don't have any other questions pending. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let me ask a question in follow-up to what you were just talking about. One of you mentioned the Yates memo. It's a memo that came out of the U.S. Department of Justice concerning the prosecution of individuals as opposed to or maybe in addition to corporations, that is, individual officers and employees of corporations. How does this case, at least potentially, it's undecided, but how does this case sort of operate with the Yates memo? What are the implications of the Yates memo? This prosecution obviously began before the very recent Yates memo.
Right. I'll take that first, but Jack, feel free. This is Paul. This case did take place before the Yates memorandum came out, but to me, this seems like this is an example of how abusive the policy enunciated in the Yates memorandum can play out, whereby here the company, as soon as the raid took place, they came and said, oh, look, you know, we'll plead guilty. I mean, we'll not plead guilty. Just give us a deferred prosecution agreement. If their executives did it, we'll basically throw them under the bus. And the Yates memorandum now makes that clear, that if the company wants to get credit for compliance with the government and be eligible to escape prosecution by getting a deferred prosecution agreement, that they have to basically have a duty to turn over the employees and the executives to the government, acting as, in effect, deputy FBI agents and prosecutors for the government. So I think if this case is affirmed, the Yates memorandum will be all that more applied in a more robust fashion. And on the other hand, if this case is reversed in whole or in part, I think that might give the government pause in terms of how they can be using this kind of leverage with the company to go after the individuals.
And this is Jack. Separate and apart from this case, the Yates memorandum is likely to increase the necessary ante for a corporation to obtain a deferred prosecution agreement and make it more express to the company that it doesn't need, it can't simply cut its former executives and employees loose. It may have to drop a major dime on them. And the restatement of earnings in this case is something of that in that nature. And it raises a serious question. In that restatement, the new board or the new company exonerates itself and says the problems are attributable to the old guys. Why do we care? We don't. Why do we care what these folks think? It's the job of the attorneys, the witnesses, and the jury to determine whether there's criminal conduct, not someone else outside the courtroom. And I think so that's, there's that question that's lurking behind all of this.
Yeah, and I'd also like to point out that this Yates memorandum seems to go contrary to policy already in the United States Attorney's Manual that specifically says that I'm reading from the manual, section 9-27.250, where it says, when a person has committed a federal offense, it is important that the law respond promptly, fairly, and effectively. This does not mean, however, that a criminal prosecution must be initiated. It says, in recognition of the fact that resort to the criminal process is not necessarily the only appropriate response to serious forms of antisocial activity, Congress and state legislatures have provided civil and administrative remedies for many types of conduct that may also be subject to criminal sanction. Examples of these are civil tax proceedings, civil actions under the securities, customs, antitrust, and other regulatory laws. So here you actually have instruction that the government, before they use the heavy hand of criminal prosecution, where these defendants are facing up to 3 years of hard prison time, that you be reasonable here and not engage in over-prosecution where there are both civil and administrative remedies, and in this case where the state can handle this kind of a violation and should handle these kinds of violations. So, I mean, we see this that came up on the Supreme Court in the Yates case dealing with the fishermen. It's ironic that Yates has the same name as the Yates Memorandum in the Justice Department, where they were using Sarbanes-Oxley to go after this fisherman for throwing undersized fish overboard and therefore destroying a tangible object. There the court and even the dissent was talking about this problem of over-criminalization where the government is going after individuals and businesses for so-called crimes when, in fact, these are violations at best and if so can be handled, as Congress has said, civilly, administratively. I mean, you have environmental statutes and workplace safety rules where it's clear that the prosecution has the government civil administrative remedies to use as well as criminal remedies. And so this is one example of abusive prosecution, of over-prosecution. In this case, I think even selective prosecution because, as we talked about earlier, there were other companies doing the exact same thing in terms of counting their expenditures to their wholly owned subsidiary, and they were not prosecuted. So you have to take a step back and see how much power the government has here. And if I may, I'd like to quote from a former Attorney General Robert Jackson, who then became a Supreme Court justice. At his second annual conference to U.S. attorneys in April 1940, he said, and this is, I wish I were emblazoned on every prosecutor's home page of their computer, he said, quote, "The prosecutor has more control over life, liberty, and reputation than any other person in America. His discretion is tremendous. Any prosecutor who risks his day-to-day professional name for fair dealing to build up statistics of success has a perverted sense of practical values as well as defects of character. He should select the cases for prosecution in which the offense is the most flagrant, the public harm the greatest, and the proof more certain." And in terms of the public harm the greatest, this came up in the oral argument. The judge was basically saying, well, what's the harm here? What was the government, what did they lose? And Seth Waxman said, well, after all the dust settled and there was a loss hearing, instead of the millions and millions of dollars they said they were being overcharged, the actual loss, even using their government's best number, was $133,000. Now, you know, you're finding that this case spent millions and millions of dollars on both sides to prosecute these businessmen to where there's obviously administrative and civil remedies. So we think that this was clearly a case of abusive prosecution. So this is important, I think, for as one of the caller called in saying what this portends in terms of future type cases.
We do have one caller question pending. Before we go to that caller, let me just play devil's advocate a bit and ask you a question about general deterrence. I mean, regardless of the stakes in this case, can't the government reasonably argue that part of its job is to dissuade other criminals? And when they have a case that seems typical of maybe some other crimes, they should publicly prosecute. Prosecute and do so very publicly in order to make an example of some folks and therefore deter some other potential bad actors.
Yeah, now that may be a legitimate reason to prosecute where you have a clear violation of the law. There may be examples where there are cases of fraud being committed that's clear where there's a loss fake numbers were put up and fake patients and all that they may want to publicly prosecute somebody to deter others from that conduct. But here, what's there to deter? In other words, if in fact you're reasonably interpreting a statute where your general counsel said it was reasonable, where the former head of the Florida Medicaid said it was reasonable, where they showed that that this was one reasonable interpretation, that's what you're going to deter. You get into the area of over deterrence. You're going to get into where companies will unnecessarily not being able to interpret the regulations that they are subject to in a way that's reasonable for fear that we may get prosecuted by the government. Because they may not like the way we're interpreting it, in which case you have a phenomenon of over-deterrence, which is not what the interest of justice is. So it depends, Dean, on what the facts are, what the nature of the alleged crime is. And as I said earlier, they could exact their pound of flesh administratively and civilly. If they thought the contract was being broken, you can assess a penalty. You can debar them from continuing in this Medicaid program, et cetera. So there's plenty of other ways to deter if, in fact, there's a violation here other than throwing these executives in prison. Jack, would you add to that?
Yeah, let me go to something that I mentioned before. If the federal Medicaid agency looks at Florida and sees that it's not just WellCare, but it's a bunch of companies that are using wholly owned subsidiaries and affiliates to accomplish various things, and it's giving all this money to Florida, it has the power to tell Florida what conditions to put on that. And maybe that's the best way to deal with it rather than prosecuting one of a number of companies that's doing the same thing.
Yeah, and that's a good point, Jack, because in the amicus brief filed by the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers that was signed on to by several law professors and a couple of groups, it was pointed out that the federal Obamacare-type analog to all this in terms of how you compute these 80-20 ratios has approximately 30 different regulations, guidances, directives where, you have to put on a green eye shade and plow through this stuff to figure out and how you crunch these numbers. And yet with Florida, they didn't have anything other than the five or six words in the statute for the provision of behavioral health services. And so the answer to all of this is that the government should not be rewarded for not making clear what conduct is permitted and not permitted, especially in the criminal area. So, you don't want to use somebody as an example to try to deter others, where the others will say, "Well, what's the rules of the road? We still don't know what's permissible conduct," and that's where you get into the phenomenon of over deterrence.
All right, we've still got about 15 minutes left. We've got one question pending. The caller's been waiting patiently, so we'll turn to him or her momentarily. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your phone. Let's now take this next call.
You said the this should be a regulatory dispute. My understanding of the evidence that came from news reports was that the wholly owned subsidiary was intentionally created by the officers of the company as a ruse to hide the excess profit that they had from the state, and there were undercover recordings of their conversations in which they were talking about how they needed to create this subsidiary so that they could hide the profit that they would otherwise have had to return to the state, and that they basically made up the numbers in order to satisfy the state and to divert suspicion. What do you have to say about that?
The government suggested that the numbers were made up today in the argument, and that fits their model of the Whiteside rule is one to be decided by the jury. The reasonableness is to be decided by a jury. Setting up the wholly owned subsidiary as a ruse is pejorative, because one could set up the wholly owned subsidiary as other corporations were doing to capture another level of overhead, and that's the question. Does the statute, the contract, or the regulations, or the template prohibit you from capturing that level of overhead?
Well, the other thing, Jack, this is Paul, is that it was clear that this wholly owned subsidiary was disclosed to the regulators. They were companies were doing that. They knew full well that a wholly owned subsidiary was being used. There was nothing about that was underhanded at all. The only question it came down to is, what do you count in terms of your expenditure? Do you count all the money you give to the wholly owned subsidiary, or only that, or as the government says, no, only what they spend directly to a doctor or psychiatrist, et cetera? And as Seth Waxman said, look, the contract has language on how you define that. So if it wasn't sure. One reason it was set up was to increase profits, but that profits were made legally. They maintained in court, and it was a reasonable interpretation. If the government doesn't like it and thinks that, well, you know, we think. I think it actually came out in argument that Judge Hall says, well, they might have been doing this to circumvent what the government thought should be the proper way. Well, as I said earlier in a parallel case in the Eighth Circuit, the judge there said, look, if the company wants to use what's called an opportunistic interpretation of a statute to their benefit, that's not a crime. You may not like it. You may think it's underhanded. As we all know, it's perfectly illegal to engage in tax avoidance as opposed to tax evasion, where you're hiding your income, et cetera. But if you're setting up your company or your personal affairs to avoid paying taxes, even though the IRS says, oh, geez, you know, you're really using a sharp interpretation of the statute, well, that's too bad. If you don't like it, change your regulation, make it clear, but don't throw us in prison where our interpretation is a reasonable interpretation of this vague statute.
If a regulation is clear, then you have an incentive to, quote, circumvent, close quote it. If there's a clear prohibition, those are the kinds that are circumvented. If WellCare is correct that nothing in this is clear, circumvention doesn't really seem to be at issue. I hope that's responsive to your question.
This is Dean. I want to challenge you or return to the Yates memo for a bit, if we could. And for the audience, that's the recent Department of Justice memo that announces an intent, I guess, to prosecute, or gives direction to prosecutors to prosecute individuals and not just corporations. That's caused a bit of a stir in the legal community and I guess in the business community as well, since some individuals now would be subject to prosecution in ways they weren't before. What's wrong with that notion? And, you know, when we see corporations prosecuted, the objections I've heard are, well, the in corporate crime cases, the shareholders are often the ones who have suffered. They've often been defrauded by individuals, or either corporate officers or employees, and they've suffered under the fraud. They've lost money under the fraud. And now, if the corporation is prosecuted, even to the point of indictment, the corporation might dissolve and the shareholders are left with diminished value. Even if the corporation survives, any settlement or payment comes out of the corporate treasury, I suppose, and it's ultimately paid by the shareholders. Given that, I mean, I hear objections to prosecution of corporations and prosecutions of individual actors. Maybe you could talk about that for a while, not necessarily in the context of the Clay case and that fact pattern, but just generally.
Well, this is Paul. That's a very good question, Dean. I mean, obviously, a corporation is a fictional entity. They can only act by their agents, and the agents are the people in the company. But the question then becomes, when the government is trying to use their leverage, their prosecutorial powers, to force the company, if they're going to get a break by being a deferred prosecution agreement, that they have to basically turn on all their employees in a way that, you know, it depends upon what is involved in terms of the wrongdoing. The company is going to say, hey, here, you know, they're going to be forced, in order to get that break, turn over people that may not be the guilty party. And in a lot of these kinds of cases with the company, there are various actors that there really is no one person who says, yes, let's put out an adulterated product and it's, and have the consumers get sick or die from this particular product. In a lot of these kind of cases, they're using the company to go after their employees. It does a lot of problems with respect to attorney-client privilege and with respect to employees being able to be frank with their fellow workers and their bosses in terms spotting problems that may be, say, in a factory, there may be some problems with the valve is not working properly, and they said, well, gee, you know, I better not bring this to attention, because by trying to correct the problem, that may come back to bite me, because if the prosecution wants to go after this company for environmental violation, they're going to come after me for being the one that was the cause of the problem, when in fact they may be trying to correct the problem. I'm not saying that it shouldn't happen, that those who are officials or employees in the company should not be prosecuted for clear wrongdoing. What I'm suggesting is that there has to be, first of all, whether or not the actual crime is one that is a crime to begin with by the company. And the company is quick to turn everybody over and let the government basically avoid using reasonable civil administrative remedies and get their maximum pound of flesh by forcing the company to basically sow this kind of discontent with their employees and cause distrust. And I think in terms of just the business model, that can only chill an effective operation of a company as a whole. But again, you know, those are good questions, but again, there has to be a reasonable balance here. And I think the government is going too far on one side of this particular method of prosecution.
Dean, this is Jack. I agree on the problems with prosecuting corporations. I go back to the indictment of Arthur Andersen, which left a great big smoking hole in the economy that benefited primarily Arthur Andersen's competitors. If the government had indicted WellCare, it would have been for the benefit of WellCare's competitors, some of whom were doing the same thing. As far as the individuals go, if in a corporation an individual acts in ambiguous circumstances and is put to the burden of truthfully disclosing information to a corporation in the course of its investigation or remaining silent and possibly being fired for remaining silent, the bargain, the employees are going to be in a very difficult position if that information truthfully disclosed can turn into something that can result in their indictment. And on the federal front, I don't remember exactly the warnings that federal employees get, but you know, they're the Garrity warnings that you have a duty. My recollection is you have a duty to testify truthfully, and if you don't, then discipline will be taken against you. The Weingarten rule about you have a right to a presence of an attorney, of a union representative, and things like that that are protective of the interests of employees.
Let me make a final call for questions here. We've got a couple minutes left for a final question. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone if you've got a question. Seeing none, let me give each of you a chance, just a minute to express a final thought or wrap up. And as you do that, I'm curious to know whether you have any sense that if the defendants lose at this level, are they likely to try to get to the Supreme Court?
Yeah, Dean, this is Jack. I don't want anything that either Paul or I said to be taken as an indicator that either of us has any idea how the panel will rule. That said, we do have our views that we've expressed in this call. I think that there are issues which may be cert-worthy, and I think these defendants would be motivated to ask the court to consider them.
Yeah, this is Paul. I agree with Jack there that there are some very cert-worthy questions here dealing with Whiteside and mens rea if they were to lose. This case may come out in several ways, since there were four appellants, and several issues involved, one dealing with false statement to the FBI that we didn't talk about in the call but raises some interesting issues. So you might have one of these things where the court may reverse in part, remand in part, et cetera. And I think however it comes out, there might be a petition for rehearing en banc with the 11th Circuit on some of this, and I think maybe to the Supreme Court. But I felt that the defendants had a good argument here. The government was basically avoiding the mens rea and the Whiteside issue and just try to play up that, well, this is all evidentiary, Your Honor. The jury looked at it, and you're supposed to give us the benefit of the doubt to the government on appeal. So they're sort of putting all their eggs in that basket, and we'll see how it goes. But it's a very important case, as we said at the top of the call, for the whole issue of the regulated community, how they can be targets of criminal prosecution. And again, it raises the issue of abusive prosecution where there are adequate civil administrative remedies. Like if you're a bank robber, you can't bring a bank robber before an administrative law judge because those are malum in se crimes. These are malum prohibitum, and as I like to call them, malum regulatum, where it's not inherently wrong. It's just a matter of making clear to the regulated community what the rules are and make sure that the government makes that clear with fair notice to everybody.
Well, gentlemen, this is Dean Reuter. I want to thank you for your time today and for attending oral argument, too, as well. We appreciate the comments, and keep tracking this case for us. Maybe we'll have you back when there's a decision and maybe a next step. I also want to thank the audience for joining us today. A reminder to check our website for a schedule of upcoming conference calls as the Supreme Court opens its term next week. But until that next scheduled call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.